Thank you. And then my understanding is the Homeowners Association and the Restoration Association want to divide their time, 12 to restoration and 3 to the Homeowners Association. And then the question is, do you want to borrow the, do you want to just cede your time to the Homeowners Association? Yes, you may. What I'll do is I'll have Jason just put the 15 up, and you can use it 12-3, 11-4, whatever you want to do, but it could end up 15-0 if the Restoration Association doesn't stop.
Okay.
So I'll leave that part to you. And then under our rules, there will be 5 minutes for rebuttal if the appellants wish to use that time. As you approach the podium, give us your name and the party you represent. We're recording the proceedings, and we want to make sure for future reference that we know who's speaking and on whose behalf. With that, appellant may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Oliver Larson. I'm with the Attorney General's Office. I represent the Department of Natural Resources and its commissioner. So I've come here today really with prepared remarks on two issues in particular I'd like to talk to you about. And the first issue is I want to talk about what the essential nature of this case is, because I think if we can get to the bottom of that and understand what this case is about, there's a natural resolution to the legal issues in this case. And the other thing I'd like to do for you is kind of give you a very high-level presentation on the fact issues we've appealed, and in particular identify you where I think are some broader concerns with the approach the district court took, both in resolving the fact issues and then how it described what it did in its opinion. And I don't want to bury the lead on that. I think one of the issues in this case is that not only were there erroneous fact findings by the district court, but some of those fact findings were in contravention of uncontested bodies of evidence. And not only is that a problem in and of itself, but the district court in its opinion didn't really explain how it overcame some of this uncontested evidence. And then we're left then with a very difficult task in trying to figure out how the district court did what it did. But let me talk about the essential nature of this case first. And I think what we do is we start with the word conduct, because that's what MIRA regulates. MIRA regulates conduct that has a material adverse impact on a natural resource. And so at root, what is the conduct at issue in this case? What is the conduct that is alleged to have an impact on White Bear Lake? It's groundwater pumping. That's the conduct that in a real world way actually impacts the elevation of the lake. Now, in their suit, the plaintiffs brought the suit against the DNR. And so there is essentially a causal jump that's being made to go from the actual conduct that's impacting the lake, which is the pumping, to the DNR on the theory that it's the DNR's permitting activity that allows that pumping to take place. And when you put aside for a moment whether that really meets the definition of conduct, here's the real issue. If that's what we're talking about, if they're going to make that first causal jump from the actual pumping to the permits, then we're in Section 10. Right, if what we're talking about is, are those permits adequate to protect the public interest in White Bear Lake? That's a Section 10 claim that should have been brought there with all of the administrative process that respects general administrative law in Minnesota.
I want to understand exactly what that means if we were to agree with you. So the district court proceeded under 0.03. There's this trial, all of these orders that are being appealed. Now, if she had agreed with you and gone under Section 10, what would it have looked like at the district court? What are you asking this court to do?
So we would have had a very short trial, if a trial at all. Essentially, the presentation is there's a low bar in a Section 10 action. All the plaintiffs would have had to do is come forward with material evidence that the permits might be inadequate to protect White Bear Lake. If the plaintiffs put on that prima facie showing, then what happens is the district court then enters an order saying the whole matter needs to be remanded back to the agency for what would be essentially here administrative contested case procedures, in which the DNR would determine which of these permits need to be reopened, and then ultimately, if there's going to be changes to the permits, what those changes are going to be. And then after that process is complete, the culmination of that process would be an order from the Department of Natural Resources saying, here are the new permits, assuming that there are permit changes made. And then the plaintiffs would be able to elect one of two remedies. They could either go back to the district court under the provisions of MIRA and say, DNR still hasn't gotten this right, order them to do it again. Or alternatively, I think they would have the right to go straight to the Court of Appeals on those permits under the normal certiorari review process and say, you know, those permits were entered erroneously. So I think they basically have an election of remedies which way they want to go. And frankly, there's not a lot of case law on that, but that's how I read the statute.
Point 10 seems to suggest subdivision 3 that you'd return back to the district court. That was my interpretation. I'm not parsing the language.
No, I agree. And I think you'd have to read that together with the general kind of 1463 Administrative Procedures Act, where they have a right. It's just because if a new permit
agency is action that right. might be cert
exactly
reviewable.
Right. If there's a new permit issued, my view of it is there's a new permit issued, they could probably take it directly to the Court of Appeals, but they could also elect to take the remedy to go back to district.
We're probably
court.
Getting ahead of ourselves. Yeah. Then. Go ahead.
You're focusing
on conduct. That's the word that appears in 03 sub 1, that it is conduct taken by a person pursuant. That falls within the exception, correct?
Yes, but the word conduct also appears in 116B02, the definitional sections. So if you go and look at the definition of pollution, impairment, or destruction, the word also appears there, right?
Conduct by any person.
Exactly right.
And
so
person is essentially all persons and agencies and municipalities and everything and everybody.
Correct. And just to address maybe the White case, which is one of the cases that came up, like if the DNR was the party actually drilling the well and pulling out the water, if the DNR is, or the Department of Transportation, for example, is building a highway and they're paving over a wetland, they're clearly subject to action under Section 3. The issue here is when we're not talking about the actual actions of the agency itself, which are having the impact, but rather their allowance of some other third party to do that through a permit, we're not really talking about conduct. And if we are, we should really be in Section 10. But I think there's another point here. I think plaintiffs understand that this is a problem, and so they've tried to take a step back. What we're really seeing are kind of two causal jumps. They're going from the actual pumping to the permits, and then they're attempting to make a second jump from the permits to something else. And they don't really explain what that something else is. If you read their brief, it's very general. And they talk about, and this is at page 21 of their brief, they say they're not challenging the permits, they're challenging DNR's failure to manage the state's water resources through its overall permitting process. I'll be honest with you, I don't know what that means. And I don't know how the overall permitting process is different than the permits themselves. I mean, how is it that you're challenging the process by which the permits are being issued, but you're not challenging the permits themselves or their adequacy? And I think the issue then is what I suspect, or at least the best that I can suss out, is what they're challenging is essentially the back office work that's occurring at DNR. What they're saying is that the science and policy staff at DNR is not doing a good enough job. The analysis that they're doing isn't good enough, or it's not the right kind of analysis, or it wasn't done quickly enough, or the DNR didn't implement that analysis at the right time and in the right way. And that puts them dead into the National Audubon Society versus PCA case that we've cited to you. It deals with an EIS, and I think that's a wonderful analogy for this case, right? If what you're challenging is not actual permitting activity or the actual actions that are impacting a natural resource, if what you're challenging is just general analysis that's going on at a state agency, that's not conduct that's actionable under any provision of MIRA. And that's what the National Audubon Society versus PCA case said. In that case, the PCA was, the allegation was that PCA should have done an EIS related to a paper mill, essentially was operating up north. And they said, well, you didn't do an EIS, that's conduct within the meaning of MIRA. It led to the paper mill maybe getting a permit they shouldn't have gotten or in the wrong way, and that's actionable under MIRA. And what this court said was, hold your horses. Look, generalized analysis going on in a state agency is not conduct. The conduct that's occurring in that case is, what is the paper mill doing? And the court refused to take up an EIS challenge in the context of Section 3. So, again, if the plaintiffs are walking back from the permits, if they're taking two causal jumps, if they're going from the actual pumping to the permits and then just to generalized analysis being done by the DNR, it's not actionable under any provision of MIRA. And I think probably I'm making this too complex, because just at root, what is this case about? What actually happened in this case? What did the plaintiffs ask for, and what did they get? What they asked for in their complaint, what they asked for at trial, what they asked for in their post-trial submissions to the court were actual changes to actual permits. And that's what the district court did. And plaintiffs try to walk back even from that. In their brief, one of the things they say, and this is in the context of the necessary parties argument, is that the district court only suggested potential changes to the permits. That's not accurate. The court ordered DNR to make actual changes to actual permits, and that's what this case is about. And that's because it's the only tool in the DNR toolbox. When we're talking about groundwater pumping and the DNR goes and looks at this toolbox and says, what can I do about it? There is only one tool in that toolbox, and that's permits. And so if the DNR is taking action with respect to groundwater pumping, it's taking action on permits, whether to issue them, whether to deny them, whether to modify them. I do want to spend just a little bit of time talking about the fact issues. And so, you know,
let me ask you this.
Go ahead.
If we agree with you with regard to point 10, do we need to reach the fact issues? What do we need to reach? If we were to agree with you, I'm not saying we do, but...
Right. If you agree with us on 10, then the district court didn't have jurisdiction to enter fact findings, and then all you need to do is essentially strike the fact findings, and then I think you can do one of two things. You could either remand it with directions to dismiss the case because it was brought in the wrong section of MIRA, or, look, I'll be realistic with you. I think probably what you're actually going to do in that event is you're going to remand it with directions that be treated as a 10 action and then subsequently remand it to DNR for proceedings consistent with Section 10. And we'd be okay with that.
There's too many pages. In fact, I think there's over 19,000 pages. But I believe the complaint actually says under MIRA 0.01 to the end of MIRA, I think that it was pleaded broadly enough to include both 03 and 0.10.
I don't need to dispute the point with you. If you look at the motion to dismiss briefing, we were really at loggerheads on that. But again, I'm not going to tell this court that it doesn't have the ability to remand this case and say, treat it as a 10 case and then send it back to the agency.
Well, and then would you agree that the district court, by her findings, did find what she needed to find by the preponderance of the evidence that it should go back?
Yes, but because the standard is very different, right? The standard in a 10 action is simply, is there material evidence that the permits are inadequate? And the answer to that question is yes, there is.
You concede that.
Yeah, we concede that. The point then is we need to go back to the agency and determine what the remedies are going to be, which permits actually need to be amended, and what's going to happen. So if you'll indulge me, I'll just want to talk about the fact issues briefly.
So, Council, I want you to go back to the Section 10 action that you described just for a second. So when I read the language of the statute, it does refer to permit in the singular, and it seems to be everything in your argument acknowledges that we are talking about permits, plural.
Yeah,
your necessary party arguments, for instance, certainly acknowledges that. So you anticipate that a Section 10 action would allow the same plaintiffs to proceed against multiple permits in some kind of consolidated action? Obviously, that's not in front of us today,
right,
but
no.
I just want to understand your
reading. Let me explain it this way. I think one thing they could have done is said, we are attacking the following permits and listed them. I think another avenue that they could have pled this case is essentially how they did plead. They could have come in and said, you know, we are challenging every permit that impacts White Bear Lake, whatever those permits are. And then in the first stage of the district court, when we're determining whether it goes back to the agency, one of the determinations the district court would make are, okay, which permits am I going to send back? And essentially, I think the court could do the same kind of analysis it did. Everything within 5 miles or everything within 7 miles or whatever it is. There's no reason that a plaintiff in a 10 action can't bring essentially an aggregated challenge to a set of permits if that's the nature of their claim.
And if we were to publish, what would the syllabus point be?
I'm sorry?
If we were to publish this case.
Yes.
Should we, and is there a syllabus point that you would recommend?
Oh, I think you should publish this. I think we're probably on our way to the Supreme Court, to be honest with you. The syllabus point I think I would make is that where there are challenges to the permitting activity of a state agency, the proper avenue for that type of action is that it should be brought under Section 10 and not Section 3.
And I did not hear you make reference to the no action provision.
Yes, I would rely on the briefing for that. And I think it's actually probably most useful in this sense. It would be a very strange thing if the legislature created a statute that says where a permit is issued, you can no longer sue the entity, and instead the remedy we're giving you is a Section 3 action against the state agency that issued the permit. I mean, if that's what the legislature wanted to accomplish, it seems to me they would have been very direct in saying that that's what they wanted to accomplish. And we've cited to you some of the legislative history, and what you see is what they really wanted, if there's a permit that's preventing a Section 3 action, then what they wanted was for plaintiffs to then go into Section 10 and challenge the adequacy of that permit, with the ultimate decision of fact findings being made at the state agency under Section 10.
So you did cite legislative history, and just because parties have a disagreement about what a statute says doesn't mean it's ambiguous? Are you saying that the statute is ambiguous since you cited that?
Absolutely not. If you read the statute together, and it's very clear when you read the statute, the challenges to permit should be brought under Section 10. What we did is cite the legislative history to you to explain why the construction is what it is. I think there's some useful, you can get into the mind of the legislature and understand why they did what they did, but I don't know that you need to, but if you're interested in that, I think the legislative history explains that. All right. Let me try to talk about the facts. If you want to interrupt me, I'm not bothered about that, but let me say this. One of the problems with the district court's opinion overall is that there were lots of uncontested pieces of evidence that came in, and then the court made fact findings that were directly contrary. When I say uncontested, what I'm saying is the fact issues that we raised in the case were not ones that came down to conflicts in testimony. This was not something where the district court said, one witness said the light was green, one witness said the light was red, and I had to resolve that. So, you know, take the USGS report, for example, right? Critical report in the case. Essentially, what the plaintiffs use it for and what the district court used it for is say, hey, look, DNR, when you saw this report in 2013, you should have known there was a problem and you should have done something about that. And the key facet of that is that three expert witnesses took the stand at trial, two for the defendants, one for the plaintiff. All three witnesses said that the key piece of that analysis was not reliable because of errors that the USGS had made and how it approached that analysis. And yet, in the district court opinion, it relies on that report extensively, both substantively and for the process point.
But it is still a USGS report, right?
Well, okay.
And it is in the record.
Yes, but let me say this. As a district court judge, and you're confronted with the following evidence, you've got a report that came in from USGS. USGS doesn't testify. The three experts who do testify, including the plaintiff's experts, say it's not reliable. At minimum, and this is really the point I'm trying to make, if you're going to rely on that report, as a district court judge, you need to explain why. Because I don't know how the district court got past that testimony, but more importantly, you don't know either. And if you read the district court opinion, it reads much more like a piece of advocacy, where it's marshaling evidence rather than describing what the evidence was and how it resolved that, and that's a problem.
You will have 5 minutes on rebuttal. All right. So we'll put 15 on the clock. Restoration Association will go first. You'll have to guide yourself on time and identify yourself and the party before you begin.
May it please the court. My name is Katie Crosby Lehman from Cerise Conlin. I'm here on behalf of White Bear Lake Restoration Association. With me to speak today is Byron Starnes, who is from the Homeowners Association. He intended to speak on public trust. It does not appear that that came up at all, so I'm likely to be here for your honors. Mm-hmm. I think I need to correct a few things. The nature of this case is not on individual permits. The nature of this case is the DNR's failure to follow its legislative mandate to allocate the use of waters of Minnesota. This comes from Minnesota Statute 103G.255. The DNR is not acting pursuant to any permits. It's acting pursuant to its legislative mandate to manage our waters. And it was this gatekeeping function that is at issue in this case. It's no individual permit. Like many environmental issues, one individual straw in a large bathtub is not the problem. It's a regional management. Only the DNR has that information in order to make that regional management. And it's the failures. Those failures the DNR knew about for many, many years, in fact, over 20 years. Starting in 1998 with the DNR's own study, the DNR knew that White Bear Lake and the aquifer were hydraulically connected. That means they rise and fall together. The DNR knew that the long-term health of the aquifer and of the lake are dependent on the groundwater appropriations. So the DNR knew this.
Dependent on that, among other things.
Only two things, Your Honor.
Not rainfall?
That's the other one, climate. There are only two factors that impact the groundwater level and the lake level. And only one of them is controlled by human conduct, which brings us directly to the purpose of MARA. 116B.01 highlights the purpose of MARA. We have a detailed recitation from the legislature on what the citizens of Minnesota have rights and responsibilities to do. And that's a right and responsibility to bring a civil action to protect our natural resources from pollution, impairment, and destruction. That pollution impairment and destruction standard is only in the general standard of 116B.03. It is not in 10. So let me start with 116B.03 and review that. That says any person may maintain a civil action against another. And you're right, Your Honor, there's no dispute that the DNR is a person here. So any person can bring a civil action against the DNR for protection of water. Water is expressly provided, and other natural resources from the pollution, impairment, and destruction. Pollution, impairment, and destruction is defined in 116B.02. It's defined in two ways. Both of them are at issue here, and one of them is completely ignored by the DNR and all appellants in their briefing and in the argument today. And that is the violation of the law. It is a violation. It's an automatic, you know, go to the finish line, you win, if the pollution impairment destruction is a violation of an environmental law, rule, or standard. Here, the court found that there have been violations of at least four environmental rules or standards. One is 103G.211 on draining the lake. Public water may not be drained unless it's replaced. The court found that as a violation. Another is 103G.287 and 285. When groundwater use negatively impacts surface water, then you have to follow the surface water regulations, and they weren't followed. Another is 103G.287 subdivision 5, and that is that the DNR has to manage.
What was the number again? G?
287. Subdivision 5.
Thank you.
And that is that groundwater must be managed in a sustainable way. And the evidence at trial and the expert testimony, the DNR's own admission shows that DNR is not managing in a sustainable way. The last one is Rule 6115.0670, Subdivision 3C3. And this one says if the DNR does not have adequate information to assess the impact of its appropriations, it can't appropriate the water or it has to issue on a conditional basis. So if it's true that the DNR didn't know enough, it shouldn't have been acting. And this is the safeguard for that one. None of these rule violations, none of this kind of pollution, impairment, or destruction can even be brought under Section 10. So that means we have no way of forcing the DNR to follow the law by reverting to a Section 10 case. Section 10 only allows us to challenge an existing law, to change it, not to enforce it.
An existing
permit?
Permit.
It has a laundry list of things. Yeah. So permit, standard, rule, I'm paraphrasing. This is why it's not just about permits. This is why you cannot revert it to a Section 10 case. We can't force the DNR to follow the law under Section 10. We have that legislative right under Section 3 in the definition of the pollution impairment and destruction. And if the legislature wanted to make an exception for this, they would have. And they could have done it in one of two ways. When we talk about the pursuant to avenue, the DNR does not argue that it's acting pursuant to a permit that it issues. The city made that argument, but the DNR did not. But if you take a look at the pollution impairment and destruction definition, 116B.02, I call it the stink exception. So look at the very last sentence, and you'll see that pollution, impairment, and destruction cannot include a claim related to odor in the air. And that shows us that the legislature had the ability and understanding of how to make an exception for certain conduct. The legislature did not exempt any conduct relating to a permit or any lawsuit related to a permit here. Instead, we go back to the county Freeborn versus Bryson analysis for any conduct. So pollution impairment control or pollution impairment and destruction is any conduct that violates environmental laws. We talked about that. That cannot go to Section 10. Pollution impairment destruction is any conduct that causes a material adverse effect. Material adverse effect is weighted under the Schaller factors. Let's go to the any conduct. So County of Freeborn versus Bryson says any conduct is sweeping. It's all-encompassing. It's action. It's inaction. And that was confirmed by the Swan Lake case. And we also know from Swan Lake 2 that there are two avenues to challenge agency conduct. It's Section 3 and it's Section 10. But they're not exclusive. They don't overlap, and what Section 10 does not usurp Section 3. They made this argument already, and they lost. So any conduct includes the conduct of the DNR, which is it knew what was causing the lake decline. It called White Bear Lake the canary in the coal mine and the bellwether. It studied the analysis and the causation of White Bear Lake in 98. It worked with the Met Council in 2010 and agreed that White Bear Lake is vulnerable to groundwater fluctuations. It peer-reviewed the USGS 2013 report. It cooperated with the USGS in the 2013 report and peer-reviewed it, provided the data for it. And in that one, that's the factual finding that they contest. Their expert agrees with the basic findings in that report. What council says it faults the 2013 report for, it was well selection, which is a very small area that, frankly, we didn't rely on that point at trial. There was much more that we relied on, and that's, and it was agreed to by the DNR's own experts.
I'm wondering where you think the district court had jurisdiction in her order to order permittees to do anything.
So that's on, well, she didn't order permittees to do anything.
She did, as I read the order.
She ordered the DNR to assess the sustainability and to make permit changes. Those permits are permissive only. Those permits are subject to termination, change, and edit. And under Rule 6115.0740, subpart 2A, it states, in no case shall a permittee be considered to have an established a right of use or appropriation by obtaining a permit. That means they do not have a legally protected interest in the permits because they have, they're permissive only. The rule tells them they have no standard. They have no ownership rights. They have no right of use. They have no legally protectable interest. Moreover, if the DNR is violating the law, which it is, and which was found in four separate ways, having a permittee there is not going to change the court's analysis of forcing the DNR to follow the law. And that's the point of the Rivenberg case and the Ohio Valley case, which is even if you had the permit holders there, and we had two, it's not going to change the analysis because the DNR has to follow the law like any of us. And if the DNR's actions, if its gatekeeping functions of managing the state's resources and its failure to manage the resources, even with knowledge of the harm, and then its intentional misleading acts and misleading the governor and not telling him what's causing the harm, all of those things weigh in together, and it doesn't act, that's not, having a permit holder there isn't going to change the situation. So going back to Section 3, we have the any conduct, we have the material adverse effect, that is, that's the gatekeeping function, that's the action of the DNR to fail to cumulatively review the permits, to take the cumulative knowledge on a regional basis, and then make determinations on to dole out that water for each permittee. That's what the court didn't, that's what the DNR didn't do, and it never acted to correct that. We meet the prima facie case both under both prongs of the pollution impairment and destruction, under the violating the law and under the material adverse effect. So then let's look if the bar applies. The only bar to Section 3, to the any conduct in Section 3, is if you're acting pursuant to a DNR permit. The DNR is the issuer of the permit. They're not acting pursuant to a permit.
Well, actually, the precise language of the bar is that no action shall be allowable for conduct taken by a person pursuant to a permit.
It doesn't change the analysis, Your Honor, because the DNR is not acting pursuant to permits it issues. The DNR is the issuer.
But I think their argument is, I'll let them make their own argument, but that the conduct of drawing the water out of the ground is conduct that is taken pursuant to the permits issued by the Department of Natural Resources, even though the Natural Resources is not the actor, it is conduct done pursuant to their permit.
So that doesn't put them subject to the bar. The pursuant to bar only applies if you're if you're acting, if you're a municipality, for example, we couldn't sue a municipality because they're acting pursuant to a government-issued permit.
We're reading the statute differently. It says, no action shall be allowable under this section for conduct taken by a person, that is the pumping, pursuant to a permit, not that no action may be taken against a person who's acting pursuant to a permit.
Right. We might be saying that, well, let me clarify. The conduct that you're referring to is the pumping.
Right.
And the pumping taken by the, that's allowed by a government-issued permit.
Correct.
And that pumping is by a municipality, right?
Correct.
And that's the pumping, that's the conduct that's subject to the exclusion. That's not the conduct at issue here. Our allegations are against the DNR as the gatekeeper, as the manager, as the one who issues the permit. The permitting that's, the pumping that's happening is from high capacity groundwater wells. That can only happen by DNR permit.
Just so we're clear, you're now in their time, right?
Yes. And so that pumping's only gonna happen if allowed by a DNR permit. The conduct that you're talking about really is, can the DNR's gatekeeping function be subject to the any conduct under County of Freeborn versus Bryson? And it's our position that it is, because that's the all-encompassing sweeping conduct that allows you to challenge the agency. Following the DNR's analysis would turn MARA on its head. It would pervert MARA's whole purpose, because we would not be able to hold an agency accountable for impairing the environmental harm and violating the law. They want absolute immunity on water issues, and the Minnesota legislature did not give that to them. Thank you.
Thank you. There is a little time. Do you want to use it?
Stand on brief.
Okay, very well. Thank you. Does the DNR wish to use rebuttal time?
I do, Your Honor. Okay. So let me just take one issue, I think, Judge Rembert, that you had highlighted, the no action exception. I think you hit on the right point on that. It doesn't say that there's no action allowed against a particular defendant. It says there's no action allowed at all, right? So, and then, again, it gets back to what is the essential nature of the case. If the essential nature of this case is a challenge to water withdrawals, right, if that's what's causing the harm is water withdrawals, then all the water withdrawals in this case are being done pursuant to a permit. And what the no action bar says is no action can be taken for anything that's happening pursuant to a permit. And it doesn't say you can go sue the DNR. It just says no action. It's a complete bar to any kind of suit. We talk about this. One of the things that the plaintiffs raise is, you know, they have some kind of line jumping argument that if they can show that there's a violation of law, then we don't need to talk about anything else. Here's the problem with that analysis. There still needs to be conduct that violates the law. If you go read the statute, that's what it says. There needs to be conduct that violates the law. What is the conduct that DNR is charged with? The conduct DNR is charged with is the issuance or denial or modification or failure to deny permits. All the statutes that they talk about are permitting statutes. So if we're talking about violations of the law and the DNR's conduct, we're talking about DNR's conduct and issuing permits. And again, that's an action that needs to be brought under Section 10. Plaintiffs also said that essentially we're depriving them of any remedy, and that's just not accurate. Look, Section 10 provides a perfectly viable remedy for what they're seeking. They can come in, they can reopen these permits, we can go back to the agency, we can revisit what the permits need to be, how they need to be changed, and if they don't like the result, they get to come back to district court, essentially for an order from the district court to say, go do it again, or alternatively, they can take that up to the Court of Appeals. They fail to explain how Section 10 doesn't provide them with an adequate remedy. It clearly does. One of the other arguments that the plaintiffs made was about what is the purpose of MIRA. Well, I think we can also say it in the reverse. It is clear that the purpose of MIRA is not to allow district courts to essentially co-opt the machinery of a state agency. And again, I think an EIS is a wonderful analogy for this. I know that, I assume at least, that all of you have dealt with EIS litigation or with permit litigation. Well, what happens?
Or MIRA litigation.
Or MIRA litigation, right. What happens when a court decides that an EIS should have been done and it wasn't? It orders the agency or the party before it to go back and do the EIS. The court doesn't take on the task of performing the EIS itself. And the same with permits. If a court determines that a permit was wrongfully issued, the court doesn't take on the task of redoing the analysis and deciding whether it's going to issue the permit, and if so, what the terms of the permit are going to be. The district court or the court of appeals says, state agency, do it again. Do it right. And so in this case, essentially what the plaintiffs are telling you is that Section 3 of MIRA gives district courts the right to essentially grab permits or grab any other piece of a state agency's administrative function that impacts the environment, pour it into the district court, and allow the district court to make that decision. And even more strongly...
Which, in all honesty, doesn't Swan Lake 2 say some of that? That is that the DNR is by statute entrusted to set lake levels, but once there's a MIRA violation, the district court can set the lake level.
The issue, and I know that you know Swan Lake well.
Because, that I do.
Yes.
Drive past it twice a week.
Yeah, and I know that you were involved in the case directly. So the distinction here is this. There was no challenge in Swan Lake alleging that the DNR issued the wrong kind of permit.
Sure, it was against the county.
Right. And the allegation was essentially, DNR, you didn't force the county to follow the terms of your permit. To me, that's exactly analogous to our present case, right? Essentially what they're saying is, you know, that we, the DNR, didn't go out and essentially modify permits to bring them into compliance with the law. We didn't engage in essentially modifications of permits, a discretionary activity. And what Swan Lake stands for is that's what we're talking about, discretionary kind of activities, enforcement activities, bringing permits into compliance with the law or permittees into compliance with the law. That's not a mere Section 3 action. And more directly to your question, look, there just was nothing in Swan Lake in which there was an allegation made against the DNR other than the fact that it failed to force Nicollet County to do what the terms of its permit said it was required to do. So it just wasn't a challenge to the adequacy of the permit, and ultimately the Court of Appeals just found there's nothing there, that there's no action ultimately against the DNR. Got a little bit of time. I just want to return again to one final issue. Look, MIRA, essentially one of the arguments they're making is through Section 10, we can't essentially get behind the scenes and change the way the DNR is doing business. Well, I mean, that's really not what MIRA is for. And again, that gets you back to that National Audubon Society versus PCA case. The purpose of MIRA isn't so that people, district courts, or plaintiffs can get in there and change the analysis that's going on. It is targeted where the rubber hits the road. And here, the rubber hits the road with the permits, and that should be in Section 10.
It appears the panel has no additional questions. Matter is submitted. We'll issue our decision within 90 days. To say that the matter was thoroughly briefed and argued would not be doing justice to the briefing in the case. We thank you for the efforts of all of counsel. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All rise.